Welcome to A&M Conversation With, a show where Alvarez and Marsal leaders discuss the trends impacting business today.
Welcome to A&M's Conversation With podcast series. My name is Peter Vanowitz. I'm the co-head of A&M's Public Sector Services Group. During today's episode, we're going to look at the world of behavioral health care, payment, and provision at the state level. Specifically, this podcast is focused on how states and Medicaid have traditionally viewed payment for care provided in institutions for mental diseases, or an IMD, and the new ways to pay for this care through a Medicare demonstration project. More to come about what information today's episode will cover. I want to kick things off, though, by introducing my colleague, Jay Nagy. Jay is a senior director with A&M's Public Sector Services. He specializes in health and human service system transformation, and he's an expert in the areas of behavioral health and Medicaid managed care. Jay successfully led New Hampshire's pursuit of an amendment to their existing substance abuse disorder IMD demonstration authority from CMS to add reimbursement of services for Medicaid beneficiaries with serious mental illness. Currently, Jay is assisting New Hampshire in its request for a five-year extension of the IMD demonstration authority. This IMD demonstration authority is a critical part of New Hampshire's system-wide behavioral health transformation work. Today, Jay is going to share his deep knowledge of IMD demonstrations to improve access to behavioral health services and strengthening crisis stabilization. Jay will also give us a sneak peek on what's on the horizon in this emerging area of behavioral health policy. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to join you today, and I'm excited to talk about one of my passions in terms of policy.
So, Jay, for those of who may not be as familiar with the concept of IMD demonstrations, or even how states and Medicaid pays for behavioral health care, can you lay out for the audience the groundwork by educating us about the history of this type of care and these demonstrations? Where did the concept of an IMD demonstration originate? And why is a demonstration project under Medicaid even necessary in the first place?
Yeah, prior to the Medicaid program coming into existence back in the 60s, states and local communities, often cities or counties, typically had the responsibility for indigent patients or those people who couldn't look after themselves. For example, people with mental health or behavioral health issues, especially those with long-term mental health illnesses, a state or local county might set up an institution, they used to be known as asylums, to provide a treatment place and residential facility for people whose mental illness was so severe that they couldn't safely live on their own in their local community. Sometimes these asylums or hospitals were created or run by not-for-profit organizations or by religious groups. And prior to the establishment of Medicaid, states and local communities pretty much had the sole responsibility for care and housing these people who needed intensive inpatient mental health treatment. When the Medicaid program came along, the federal government didn't want to take over the traditional state responsibility of caring for these individuals, especially for those who needed that type of care on a long-term basis. So the IMD exclusion rule, one of the oldest carve-outs in Medicaid, was created. Basically, the IMD exclusion rule restricts Medicaid reimbursement for inpatient behavioral health care in settings that CMS considers to be IMDs. For the most part, this rule applies to beneficiaries between their 21st and 65th birthdays. But of course, there are exceptions, and it has proven to be a complex policy in terms of implementation. At its origin, before the Olmstead decision and during the era of large networks of state hospitals and state schools, this had the effect of limiting federal cost for and exposure to statewide institutionalization.
So that's a great history of a very complicated program but you know, certainly understand over the last 60 years, there's been a lot of changes to the way that people get treated for serious mental illness or substance abuse issues or the like. So how have those changes in therapies led to changes in the way that this might be paid for and maybe less paid for by the traditional state paying for it on an institutional basis?
Definitely. So over the intervening decades, because of advances in medication therapy, as well as an overall policy of deinstitutionalizing people, meaning trying to get patients into the least restrictive settings possible, particularly in the wake of the Supreme Court's Olmstead decision, which incidentally just marked its 24th anniversary just this week, states have been looking for ways to care for and treat these patients and leverage opportunities for Medicaid coverage of acute short-term stays that are really meant to stabilize people in crisis rather than treat them over an extended period of many years. Basically, what states found was the IMD exclusion was becoming an obstacle to their bigger picture public health objectives, particularly when it comes to behavioral health. And more recently, changing needs and a growing treatment advocacy movement have created support for finding a way around the IMD exclusion. Notably, Medicaid expansion magnified the impact of the exclusion as more patients became eligible for Medicaid coverage and thus, in theory, could benefit from reimbursement for their IMD stays. Also, historical underinvestment in inpatient capacity due to the focus on deinstitutionalization has caught up on many states and created all kinds of problems with access to behavioral health care, especially in areas not traditionally served by those big state hospital networks. Also, the opioid epidemic created a specific need for the population of patients diagnosed with substance use disorder, whose most effective setting of care might be an IMD. And eventually, the IMD capacity shortfalls have translated into increased emergency department boarding in many areas, which has all sorts of downstream impacts, including on those patients, Medicaid or not, who just need medical care and don't even need psychiatric care.
So you have this program, Medicaid program, it's been around for 60 years. And for 60 years, you've had this rule in the legislation that says the federal government through the Medicaid program is not going to pay for this institutionalized care. So how do you get around that legislative burden or that exclusion, the IMD exclusion, to try to get some Medicaid payment assistance for individuals with behavioral health, mental health needs that might otherwise be subject to this prohibition of paying for it because it's being done on an institutionalized basis?
Well, Congress provided a path forward, specifically under Section 1115 of the Social Security Act. They gave the Secretary of Health and Human Services the power to waive certain provisions of Medicaid law with the intent of furthering the overall goals of the Medicaid program. That's why this is called a demonstration. Think of it like a permission slip to disregard specific provisions of Medicaid law within a structured framework and subject to guardrails or special terms and conditions, as they're called by CMS. There's also a formal evaluation framework to determine whether the demonstration is achieving its stated objectives. The idea here is to generate real-world evidence that can be used by legislators to reform aspects of Medicaid law that may no longer be serving the original goals of the Medicaid program and may no longer be acting in the public interest. So these demonstrations are also required to be budget neutral, meaning they're subject to spending caps that CMS establishes through negotiation with states, which factor in actuarial assumptions that are unique to each state's Medicaid system. These assumptions reflect, for example, the role of managed care, the array of available services under the Medicaid state plan, local reimbursement rates, and other state-specific factors.
So So Jay, I think, as you know, I spent a good part of my career in the federal government at HHS and worked and saw a lot of these demonstration projects. As you, I think you noted it well, it's sort of like a permission slip to do something that the Medicaid Act otherwise wouldn't let you as a state do. But one of the problems, though, is that there's not necessarily a rule book out there or a list that says, here are all the things you can do under a demonstration project or a demonstration authority. It's a series of states coming to CMS, to the agency, and to the secretary saying, hey, here's something different we'd like to do. How do you feel about it? So sometimes each time it's a new adventure and a new way of acting without necessarily a rule book for how you proceed under a demonstration authority. So what are some of the ways that you do proceed? Or how do you know what the secretary might approve or what the secretary might reject?
Well, it's true that there's a lot of flexibility under Section 1115, and that states over the years have asked for all manner of permission slips to ignore or set aside, you know, all manner or all varieties of the statutes within the Medicaid program. Once there's critical mass, CMS will issue what's called a state Medicaid director letter, sometimes known by the acronym SMDL, as well as other technical documentation, all of which is available to the public online, and which ultimately establishes the guardrails for states so that they have a greater certainty that their application will be well received and ultimately approved by CMS.
So what are the SMD letters saying right now about these demonstration projects around the IMD exclusion?
The SMDL for this type of demonstration was issued in November of 2018. It specifies the character of the demonstration, that it should focus on short-term stays. It actually prohibits reimbursement of any stay above 60 days. It imposes an average length of stay of 30 days for the overall demonstration. And it specifies some of the goals that CMS hopes to see states accomplish with their demonstrations. These are goals around reducing waiting in emergency departments, increasing connection with community-based care, and overall promoting access to the full spectrum, the full array of behavioral health care services that a person in Medicaid might need. These letters also set out specific milestones that states have to achieve. They set the terms of the monitoring and evaluation, which is necessary to prove whether or not a demonstration is having its intended effects. And they also promote certain policy objectives, which I alluded to briefly, specifically in this case around care coordination, healthcare IT, and financial investment in community-based care.
Thanks, Jay. That's a very helpful look back through history. And often when dealing with the Medicaid program or the Medicare program, you really do need this history because both of the programs have been in effect for almost 60 years. And there's been a lot of rules, there's been a lot of precedent set, and the agency likes to look at precedent. So having explained the IMD exclusion, why it exists, the demonstration authority that's out there, and how states are trying to avail themselves of this demonstration authority, it is complicated. And there's a lot of work associated with applying for a demonstration waiver. They're not always successful. So why might an individual state decide to undertake this complicated process and pursue an IMD demonstration, especially since the state never knows if their demonstration project is going to get approved? Are there any common themes that you see when looking at IMD demonstrations that have been approved and those themes or those constructs that you might apply if you were a state and you wanted to get a waiver, which would help you with the IMD exclusion?
Well, Peter, it's certainly true that no two states are exactly the same. But as you noted, there are some commonalities in the approved demonstrations, which are operating right now across the U.S. You know, first, at the highest level, the biggest theme we see is system transformation. And what we mean by that is using demonstrations as part of a package of comprehensive behavioral health reforms or improvement measures that aim to increase the efficiency and enhance the impact of a state's behavioral health system. Many states these days are focused on improving access to crisis services. Really, we see IMDs as a crucial component of having a comprehensive continuum of care around the crisis, around crisis services. There's also an interest in reducing emergency department wait lists and boarding. And in this sense, IMD demonstrations help create financial viability for private sector providers to come in and fill the gaps in capacity that create bottlenecks, which result in the boarding in the first place. We see Medicaid reimbursement as a kind of incentive for new private sector providers, since Medicaid is such an important payer for behavioral health across the United States. Second, you know, there can be external forces that come into play. So Medicaid expansion brings new beneficiaries into the system, and that raises the stakes around securing Medicaid reimbursement for their acute behavioral health care. Legislatures sometimes commit their states to pursue demonstrations as part of a package or suite of behavioral health reforms and investments. Third, we know that most states already have an IMD demonstration focused on substance use disorder, or SUD, and there can be a lot of overlap between SUD and serious mental illness, or SMI, which is really our focus today. I'll take a moment just to talk about some of that overlap, because I think it's an important consideration. SUD-focused IMD demonstrations were part of the response to the opioid epidemic on the part of many states. They used them to expand treatment capacity to meet the growing need. At the same time, we see a significant amount of co-occurrence or comorbidity between these two classes of behavioral health disorder, SUD and SMI. Treating one condition often benefits the other. Not treating one can often exacerbate the other or cause it in the first place. And at a more basic level, there's a goal of ensuring parity and equity between and among these various conditions and the services that are provided to treat the conditions. So all of these were strong catalysts for CMS to expand what was initially an SUD-only opportunity for demonstrations to include SMI. And lastly, the final theme I'd like to highlight is that some states are using these demonstrations to specifically incentivize private IMD providers. And they do that by carving out from the demonstration their own state-owned and operated IMDs. So one state, Maryland, explicitly excludes these state-owned IMDs, and two other states, Indiana and Alabama, exclude state-owned IMDs by inference.
So Jay, you've outlined some very compelling reasons that states might undertake the hard work of applying for and implementing an IMD demonstration project, particularly, you know, around the area of substance use disorders, the opioid crisis, and how states are responding to that, and clearly a need for an exception from the Medicaid rules on what might be paid for. Are there any other reasons that a state might pursue this waiver authority, this demonstration authority, that break the mold of some of the themes that you just mentioned?
Yeah, I'd like to highlight one particular example, and that is the state of Alabama and their approved IMD demonstration. And what we see there is they're using their demonstration to specifically enhance access on a regional basis. So Alabama, like many states, experiences an urban-rural divide in terms of the provider availability and access for their residents. Specific areas of states may have, you know, more severe provider shortages, and that seems to be the case in Alabama. So they pursued a targeted regional waiver to address this type of challenge. It's also worth noting that such an approach gives states the chance to test the demonstration on a more limited basis, to dip their toes in the water, so to speak. And indeed, if you read Alabama's application, they do mention the potential for expansion along precisely these lines. So in short, even though these demonstrations exist within a defined context and a framework established by CMS, the flexibility they afford allows states to be the laboratories of innovation, a concept that is baked into the U.S. model of federalism by design.
So, Jay, I know I promised the audience at the beginning of this podcast that you would give us a glimpse into the future of IMD demonstrations. As we know, as you noted earlier, these are done on a case-by-case basis by CMS and the Secretary of HHS. But can you give us a glimpse or a summary on what you think CMS's current thinking is on these waivers and where the IMD demonstration stands nationally right now? And where might we see states going from here in the coming months and years? And what CMS and HHS might be doing in terms of some of these waivers that they're presented?
Well, it seems like momentum is building for this type of demonstration, and they're proving to be very flexible and applicable across a wide variety of states with varied interests. So these demonstrations that have been approved, they span the national map of the United States. According to our research, 12 states have had their demonstrations approved at the time of this recording, and three still have their applications pending in front of CMS. Basically, we're seeing more variety as more of these get approved, and they essentially build the evidence base that CMS is looking for when they interact with their federal partners around using the evidence created by demonstrations to potentially reform law and certainly policy. And speaking of that, you know, in terms of the future of the IMD exclusion rule and how that might impact demonstrations, it's really a mixed bag. We've seen a couple of attempts to shrink the exclusion in the last Congress, the 117th Congress. And so far, we've just seen two in the 118th Congress. I'll talk about a couple of highlights from the last Congress. There was the 988 Implementation Act of 2022, the Jim Ramstad Legacy of Recovery Act, the MIND Act, the Increasing Behavioral Health Treatment Act, and the Michelle Alyssa Go Act. And that was all in addition to a couple of bills that would have carved out Qualified Residential Treatment Programs, or QRTPs, from the IMD exclusion rule. That's probably a conversation for another day. But suffice it to say that in passing the Family First Prevention Services Act, Congress created an unintentional loophole. You might say precisely the type of loophole that demonstrations were meant to counteract in the long term. So far, you know, take us up to the more recent time period. In the 118th Congress, we saw one of the acts I just mentioned, the Increasing Behavioral Health Treatment Act, be reintroduced in February of 2023. There are a handful of co-sponsors, but as of yet, no bipartisan support. Also in the 118th Congress, more recently, H.R. 3892 was introduced by Representative Burgess of Texas just in the month of June 2023. As of this recording, the full text of that bill isn't available yet, so the potential impact isn't clear. But there is one bipartisan co-sponsor, so it's definitely something to watch. Regardless, we expect that any potential repeal would probably align closely with the demonstration requirements outlined by CMS, particularly in terms of the length of stay and the quality enhancements that CMS looks for states to achieve. And in fact, Peter, the full wholesale repeal of the IMD exclusion is relatively unlikely in the near term. And that's primarily due to the size of the costs associated with IMD stays across the United States. There was a recent analysis by the CBO that estimated the cost of eliminating the IMD exclusion for mental health stays, that cost would increase federal Medicaid outlays by $33.5 billion on net over the 2024 to 2033 period. Now, that figure is a net figure. It results from an increase of $33.6 billion in spending for the IMD stays and a reduction of, that was estimated at $100 million, a reduction in spending for care and emergency departments. It's important to note that, you know, we believe that actual emergency department savings may be much larger than this estimate, but that's still an awful lot to offset if you're trying to find the support for a full repeal in Congress.
So, Jay, you've covered an awful lot of territory today in our podcast, first by just educating the audience about this whole concept of the IMD exclusion and the challenge that it creates for states as they try to address the issue of serious mental illness, as well as increasing incidences of substance use disorder. So this IMD barrier, payment barrier, which is over 60 years old, is out there, and states have to figure out ways to, for lack of a better word, get around that or figure out if there is ways to use the Medicaid program to still reach these populations and to pay for their care. I'm glad that you gave us some of the political realities too, because a lot of people might say, well, why doesn't the federal government just get rid of this IMD exclusion and deal with the issue and pay for this care? But as you noted, the effect on the federal budget would be significant. And in the area that we're living in today, with budgetary constraints on the federal level and the state level, you can see why there's not going to be an appetite for a wholesale elimination of this historic payment exclusion.
Yeah, Peter, I think the key takeaway for me is that this is an opportunity that states should consider. They should consider it in the context of what they're trying to achieve in terms of their public policy goals with respect to their Medicaid programs, with respect to their behavioral health systems, in a public health area of growing concern and interest, driven by some of the factors that you noted. You know, it's important to remember that these type of demonstrations can be a catalyst for behavioral health system transformation. They can be a tool to help manage the opioid or substance use crisis. They can be part of addressing the growing need for behavioral health services, including crisis response, which is only expected to grow in the wake of increasing awareness of behavioral health conditions and the 988 national hotline that was put in place in July of 2022. And also important to remember, they are a potential lever that can counteract emergency department boarding that all too many states experience today. And they can be an important adjunct to Medicaid expansion, something that most states have already adopted at this point, and can view these demonstrations as a parallel policy path to pursue.
Jay, thank you so much for this background today and giving us a glimpse into how CMS is thinking about these demonstration authorities for treatment of serious mental illness and SUDs that otherwise might be subject to this IMD exclusion. It's very, very helpful information as states consider how they're going to continue to address the healthcare needs of their residents. Thanks again for being with us today. If you'd like to learn more about how we help states and local governments address these healthcare issues, please visit our website alvarezandmarcel.com. Jay, thank you again for being with us today.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe to the show so you never miss a new episode. Visit our website at alvarezandmarcel.com to learn more and to connect with us.